today's featured guest, the head of WolfStreet.com. Welcome back, Wolf Richter.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you, and what really drew my attention to send the request to you, an article you penned on the housing bubble, the U.S. domestic housing market might be rolling over, brought up some compelling evidence to support this thesis, the graphs of the Case-Shiller Index in the more bubbly cities. Why don't you tell us more, please?
Yeah, so housing is very local. So every market has its own dynamics, and they all look very, very different. So if you look at the national averages, it really, they average out the dynamics on the ground. So you can have one enormous housing bubble in one market, and you have a downturn in the other. And on the national basis, it might look kind of reasonable as it's averaged out. What I like to look at is among the big markets, so the big and expensive markets that we have in the United States, how are they doing? And some of them, many of them actually, have now surpassed by a very large margin the home value, the peak of the prior bubble. And let's remember, the peak of the prior bubble wasn't a state of calm or some kind of normal, that we want to go back to. It was the peak before it all collapsed. And so now we're in many of these markets, we are substantially above that prior peak. And a lot of people say, well, okay, so now we're finally back. We're healed where we used to be. That's not a healing process. That's a bubble process that has now exceeded the prior levels. And on a national basis for the Case-Shiller Index, their national index is now about 7% higher than during the peak of 2006. And that averages away a lot of the big cities. The movement has been much, much sharper. Some of them, like Boston, Boston's up about 13% from the peak in 2006. That kind of is explained by, the rise in the household income, those kind of things. We did have some of that. We had some inflation since then, and there's some rise in incomes also. When you're up 13%, 15% in that range, you're kind of, given the current incomes and the current inflation levels, you're kind of back where you were in 2006, 2007 in that range. It means we're back at the peak of the prior bubble. We're not much above it. We're not really below it. We're just right back. So that's what Boston is. Boston is right back where it was in 2006, 2007, after inflation and after wage increase. Seattle looks a little different. Seattle is 24% higher than during the peak of the bubble before. And, Seattle had a phenomenal bubble beforehand. And so now it's 24% higher than that. So that transcends any definition of inflation that we stick to in terms of CPI and the Fed's PCE. I know that personal inflation tends to be much higher. And if you consider the true cost of housing, the housing cost increases, it'll be significantly higher. But so Seattle is up there, 24% above the prior bubble peak. Now, Denver is nearly 50% above the prior bubble peak. And I know some people who live in Denver, and they watch this happen, and price increases are incredibly sharp. Now, this is the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It's not median prices or average prices. This is based on home sales pairs. So they look at how one house sold in 2011, and then they look at the price when it sells in March, and they apply algorithms and other formulas to figure out what the home price increase on that particular home was for that year. It's a different method of looking at it, but over the long term, it's a somewhat more conservative measure than, say, the median price, which can be influenced by a change in the mix. So if you have more expensive units selling in a particular month, that increases the median price, even though the actual prices of each individual home isn't increasing. And average prices are very, very much influenced by one home, a $50 million home selling in the market, and it moves the entire market up. The indexes we're talking about now, they're not median, not average. It's based on sales pairs. It's a pretty conservative way of looking at this. And in Denver, those prices are now 50% higher than they were during the peak of the prior bubble. In Dallas, it's 44%. Dallas has had an enormous, and that's not the city of Dallas, but Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, and it goes into North Texas, they have had a phenomenal boom since the prior housing bubble. Atlanta, of course, is another one of my favorite places because it has a perfect V-shaped recovery. I mean, it was one of the famous housing bust cities and where home prices really collapsed, surged before, then collapsed, and they have resurged. Atlanta is now above the prior peak also. Portland, another bubble city that had a phenomenal bubble during housing bubble one. Now in housing bubble two, they're 21% above the peak of the prior bubble. Now San Francisco, where I live, is a special case. Now that's the most expensive housing market in the country in terms of a metro area. This is the index is for the 5-county area for San Francisco that it includes the northern part of Silicon Valley, it includes part of the East Bay, and includes part of the North Bay. So it's not just the city of San Francisco. It's a fairly large area. Home prices here are just outrageous. I mean, it's such a handicap for employers bringing in people. I talk to people all the time about that. They get job offers to come to this area, and they can't accept them because they can't afford the home prices, and they can't afford the rent. You know, you're making $250,000 a year, and you can't even buy a starter home with that. So it's that kind of proportion. And in San Francisco, where the housing bubble one has been just breathtaking, you know, we're now 33% above the peak of the prior bubble. These housing bubbles run into problems with affordability. And in San Francisco, we call it the housing crisis. It's not a crisis of availability. There's tons of stuff available. It's just too expensive and people can't afford it. So it's an affordability crisis. It's a crisis of price inflation. And there's a reality to that. In the stock market, you don't have to eat stocks and you don't have to live in them. So they can kind of take on really absurd levels. In housing, that's not really the case. And so you run into the problem where people can no longer afford those home prices, and then eventually volume drops and eventually prices will drop. This is a situation that comes to a background. I mean, it was on the background of dropping mortgage rates. The mortgage rates have been dropping for many years, and they go up and down, but they've been on a downtrend for a very long time. They have turned around. So now today we just got the latest number from the Mortgage Bankers Association, and mortgage rates, the average 30-year fixed rate that they processed is 4.80%, which was briefly the highest rate was in 2013. And now we really have to go back to 2011 to get rates this high. The 15-year rates are already back where they were in 2011, and the FHA-backed mortgage rates are also back there. So we're looking at mortgage rates of the type that we've had in 2011, and we're looking at home prices that are 30-40% higher than they were then. How much longer can this continue? Clearly, the market is going to run into a real problem.
Thank you for that very thorough analysis. And if we're looking at an echo bubble, a housing echo bubble here, what would you point to as the key underlying causes here? If we go back to 2005, 2006, clearly we had the subprime, the Alt-A, and many other schemes that led to huge liquidity. Anyone who could fog a mirror could buy a mortgage, and that just fed upon itself. Fast forward to today, we don't have quite the same subprime, Alt-A, and other ninja loan issues. However, we do have student loan debt crisis on the horizon, credit card debt crisis on the horizon, and we have a huge number of hedge funds that have purchased up large swaths, if you will, of our real estate locally, regionally, and even across the country. Can you speak to what you believe we'll look back at as the cause of this second echo bubble?
And that's a very important question you're asking. And one reason for that are the extraordinary low interest rates that we've been experiencing. In 2012, I was just talking to people, you know, they bought some rental property back then, and they financed at 3.5%, 30-year fixed. When you think about that, that makes the home purchase or the investment property purchase very cheap if you finance it on a monthly basis. You know, and then and back in 2012, that was after the housing crash, so prices were a lot lower. So those were good deals. Today, you'd have to finance the same home at 4.8%, and the price is 30-40% higher. So when we have an interest rate that consistently drops for, it's been dropping for like 30 years, essentially. And mortgage rates have started dropping in the early 1980s. They have meandered lower until, I think, 2016 was probably the historic low point in that range. You know, so 2014, there's a dip there, yeah. And so I don't think we'll revisit those levels again, ever again. I think that was part of the 30-year bull market in bonds, and mortgage rates trade like them. They're converted to bonds in many cases, mortgage-backed securities, and so that it's all related. And I don't think we'll revisit that. I think those are finished. We're looking at higher mortgage rates. And that drive down there to get to these ultra-low mortgage rates. Now, the Fed encouraged that through its QE program. The Fed bought a couple of trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities to repress these mortgage rates and make home buying cheaper. And so when you make the cost of something, the monthly cost of something cheaper, you know, you're going to get more demand for this. And then it generates this whole cycle of home prices only go up. Now it's a good time to buy. And you get the investors to plow in. And it creates a mentality where you can't lose money in real estate. And that's where we are now. You know, now I constantly hear that you can't lose money in real estate. The last time I heard that was like in 2006 and 2005. So these ultra-low interest rates have largely contributed to this. And then, yeah, the force of investors flying into this market is, domestic investors. So like you pointed out, hedge funds and PE firms that have bought a large stock of single-family homes out of foreclosure and to put them on the rental market. I mean, that's been a huge move. We now have landlords that have 45,000 single-family homes spread around some of the major markets. And there are several of them that have gone public, you know, so you can buy their shares that they're that become REITs. So this is billions of dollars that securitize the rental payments. So that Wall Street has really jumped on this. And that's been going on for years, so that's really financialized the whole housing industry. Yeah, it's financialized what used to be just a place to live, and it's now just a global asset.
When you talk about securitizing payments, brings to my mind MBS, the mortgage-backed security, and the credit default swap, CDS disaster, where you brought up housing can never do anything but go up. When that becomes the ubiquitous mantra, look out below.
Yeah, securitizing rental payments, that's a new thing. They started in like 2014, 2015. And so we have no history on this. We don't know what that will do in the next crisis. People leave their homes, you know, and then their vacancies. Securitized products then begin to fail and lose money. They're in portfolios of pension funds and spread all around, institutional investors and so forth. I mean, this is not focused on banks now. This is focused on investors. And so in a sense, I think talk a little bit about the Fed here. The Fed's worried about the banks. And so the Fed's not worried about these rent-backed securities blowing up. You know, they're private hands, they're in pension funds, so when they blow up, it's not going to be a concern for the Fed, so the Fed's not going to try to bail them out. Yeah, the Fed gets worried when banks are involved. The mortgages the banks have done are in pretty good shape. I mean, banks have quite a bit of capital. They have really been pretty critical of how they look at mortgage paper, and it's pretty pristine what they have, you know, and they have sold off that part of their risk too. What the problems we now have is these non-bank lenders have jumped into that market, and some of them are Quicken Loans has now become the biggest mortgage lender in the country, bigger than Wells Fargo. And they're not that regulated. The Fed doesn't regulate them. You know, they're not banks. And they obtain the money not from deposits, but from issuing bonds and from securitizing the mortgages that they originate. They do subprime mortgages, and their primary business model is growth. So they don't really worry that much about risk. Many of them were born after the financial crisis. So again, we don't have any history on some of them. And that's where the risks lie this time. It's not the banks. You know, this time, it's going to be the non-bank mortgage lenders. That's where the risks are. That's where the subprime is. That's where the sloppy underwriting is. Fintech companies are that use other methods to check out borrowers. I think the rent-backed securities, they'll cause some damage in pension funds, and so the Fed will ignore it. Mortgages will cause some real damage in these non-bank lenders, and the Fed will ignore it. And so in other words, this time the Fed will not step in to stop a decline in the housing market because the banks aren't at risk. And I think that's a very critical thing to think about. It was last time the Fed stepped in. And so people learned that and thinking the Fed's going to, there's a Fed put on this. You know, the Fed's going to step in when housing drops too far. And it looks like since the risk has deviated away from what the Fed is in charge of, the Fed's going to let this happen. You know, if it's happening slowly enough, if it doesn't freeze up the credit in the overall economy like it did last time, if it doesn't impact the banks, the Fed's going to let this thing slide.
So the implications, though, are profound when you add in the semi-bubble we've seen in U.S. shares and equities prices, and then the 30-year at least bubble, in, of course, the bond bubble, all of which are somewhat interest rate sensitive.
You look at what Apple just announced, that enormous amount of share buyback. Now, they're bringing all this cash back. So there's a huge amount of money after all this money printing. You know, there's a huge amount of money out there, and some of it is overseas that's not coming back. So I think what will happen is that this money will keep coming into the market. And so the market goes down some, and then this money comes back in and props it up a little bit. You know, and so we have this volatility that we've been seeing in the stock market. There may be a downward bias in the volatility, so it may go up and down and up and down, but down over the longer term. But I don't really see a major crash that could trigger, in terms of the stock market, that could trigger a nasty recession. There will be a recession in the United States. It may be a fairly minor one. You know, it may not be a big one, because until all this cash goes away, you know, this is going to come in. There's people waiting for these opportunities. You know, the hedge funds set up and there's companies set up to benefit from any small decline in asset prices. And they're going to prop this up. So if we have a downturn in the economy over the next year or two, I think in terms of the damage done to asset prices, it's going to be fairly minor at this point. My real worry is that this will drag out for a very, very long time. A tradable event like it was last time, it'll be over, you know, it'll be a year, and then you can really buy at the bottom. The fear I have is that this will meander lower for many years.
So do you see then housing returning to the mean? If we look at the overall Case-Shiller index,
yeah, no, not because it's not possible, but because there's too many people waiting for it. Kind of question whether that cat on the sideline actually exists, but there are people waiting for a downturn in asset prices. You know, you have the dip buyers jump in, and these are not retail buyers. You know, these are big hedge funds with billions of dollars. You know? And this is Apple now buying its own shares. You know, and they announced yesterday what methods they're going to use. They're going to time the market. You know, they're going to buy their own shares every time they dip. You know, Apple's going to buy its own shares. And Google's going to do the same thing, and Microsoft's going to do the same thing. I mean, that's the share manipulation scheme that we now have. It's hard to have a really steep sell-off in that. You know, housing doesn't roll over in 3 months. You know, it takes many years for a housing market to roll over. Last time it took 4 years, and that was a crisis, you know, and it's 4 years. So, I mean, this housing markets can turn down for decades.
It's almost a case of if you can't beat them, join them. I mean, we're talking about Apple, some of these big names, the blue chips, if you will, in technology, the Dow and the S&P. And so it seems as though you expect this trend to persist, and why fight it?
I think there is a dip buying momentum here, you know, so I think the momentum is downward, but slowly, and it could be a very good trader's environment. And I was talking to a hedge fund guy yesterday, you know, and they're loving this because they need volatility to trade. And they now have that volatility. They can trade. You know, they might not make money on their trades, but at least it's moving, you know. And, but in terms of stocks, you know, that what we've seen so far this year, volatile. We're kind of back to normal. We just had a very low volatility period there for a while. Now the movements in percentage terms are kind of back to normal. But also, you know, the shares peaked in January 26th, and we really have not seen anything close since then. Yeah, I think this is an environment for traders, because you're going to have a lot of movement. I don't know that a long-term investor can benefit from this market. You know, this is what I'm worried about. You know, I mean, I'm looking at Japan. You know, the stock market, you know, they're still halfway where they were in 1989. You know, so this stuff can get really, once you're in a bubble and you don't use inflation to demolish the currency, it may take a long time to work out of this. And it may not be a profitable game for a long time.
Didn't we see something similar to that after the dot-com implosion that arguably began year 2000 and culminated with the nadir of 2003? For nearly a decade, I don't believe any of the major indices eclipsed their former highs, and I think it took maybe even a little longer for the NASDAQ to return to its 5,000 peak. And so maybe something along those lines, just a decade of grueling backing and filling.
Yeah, I think that's a very plausible scenario. You know, the bond market, and we're talking about stocks, you know, stocks have been volatile. The bond market, outside of the short-term treasury end of it, the bond market is still in total bubble. You know, the junk bond market is incredibly bubblicious. And the junk bond market has never been as risky as it is now, you know, because companies have been able to sell bonds and sell other debt under the worst conditions for creditors, you know, for buyers. The contractor, we call them cov-lite, they've been getting away with it. So investors have a lot fewer protections when these companies default than they used to have. So the loss ratios will be much higher. At the same time, the yields are near record lows right now at the riskiest end of the triple C rated bonds. So that's a deep chunk. It's really in complete denial in that end of the market still. After all these rate increases and everything, the spreads between junk bonds and treasuries are near historic lows. This shows that, you know, people take enormous risks to just get a little extra return. You know, that's what the Fed is targeting. The Fed is saying, look, the risk premiums or the spreads are too narrow. They need to widen. You know, we need to increase interest rates, and we need to widen yield spreads. And so for the junk bond, and, you know, that's going to be brutal to go through that. And we've seen that. I mean, the junk bonds have been an incredibly good investment since February 2016, and they're in total bubble area right now. And they have not moved off of that bubble area. They're still there, you know. So that will move faster than 10 years, you know, and you may never get back. Because when these companies default, you know, your investment is going to get a haircut, and that's going to be a different scenario than stock. You can try to outweigh stock market drop, but once you own bonds, you know that if the company defaults, you're serious damage to your capital, and depending on what kind of bond it is, you know, that's the end of it. You know, the bond market, that's the biggest bubble we have, and it has not turned south.
But it looks as though U.S. shares will underperform. Bond market is extremely frothy, and heaven help those who have tried to chase higher yields with junk bonds. And housing also has signs of topping. We bring these three together, Wolf Richter. I mean, that comprises the majority of domestic investment. You're talking at least half of Americans have some stock bond exposure, and the rest have real estate. So we're not giving specific advice today, but are there any safe havens?
What we got to keep in mind is that investors have had it very good for the past 8-9 years, all around. I mean, except for precious metals the last 5 years. You know, in terms of the other financial investments that we have, real estate, it's been incredibly good, whether it's housing or commercial real estate or stocks or bonds, whether it's mortgage-backed securities or junk bonds or whatever. You know, classic cars, this stuff has been good. Some of it has turned around. Classic cars are starting to lose value, so that's no longer a great thing. Stocks have started to turn around. You know, bonds are still very strong. So I think overall that 8 years or 9 years of good times will be paid for by bad times. And there's no way to escape that. You know, everything went up together, and it might go down together. There are right now, you know, in terms of precious metals, you know, they've been countercyclical over the last few years. You know, I'm not a fan of them. Their countercyclicality really make them something that balances out a portfolio, and that's what you're looking for, you know. So they have not moved up with everything else. That doesn't guarantee that they won't move down with everything else, but at least they're not on the same parallel track. We also have short-term bonds now, so treasuries, for example, or FDIC-insured CDs, brokered CDs that you can buy to your broker. You know, I've done three reports on that now, because it's the first time I've seen that in 9 years. You know, 1 year CD is now offering over 2.25% in yield, and the banks are out there aggressively selling them. You know, that's the thing I haven't seen before since the financial crisis. Now banks are competing for money, so cash has value again, and this is just the beginning. So next year, a one-year CD, or, you know, you're looking at a treasury bill of the same type, you know, might offer 3.25%. And on these things, you don't make a lot of money, but when everything else is going down, capital preservation becomes a big priority. So if you have short-term treasury bonds or CDs, you preserve your capital, you don't make a lot, you know. And that at least helps balance out a risky part of your portfolio. You know, other than that, I mean, there's no way to rotate out of this in terms of bonds or stocks. You know, both went up together. Investors benefited from both. So there used to be a way to rotate from stocks into bonds and to mitigate your risk. That possibility doesn't exist today. And there used to be a way to rotate into real estate and mitigate your risk. And that doesn't really exist today anymore either. They all went up together. So we have to look at something else. And I think the good times are over. You know, having a portfolio that's prod-based and makes 20% a year, That's not going to happen anymore. You know, that those times are over. So I think capital preservation is a good strategy now.
I think you've given us some excellent guidelines here today. I'd summarize buyer beware in most asset classes, but if you have to buy something, maybe consider beta balancing investment in precious metals to keep your portfolio afloat as cash becomes more appealing over the next few years. So tell people more, please, about Wolf Street and all of the neat stuff they can find there.
Yeah, wolfstreet.com. So this is like my name, Wolf, and Wall Street. So wolfstreet.com, everything is free. We post about 2 or 3 articles a day, lots of charts and economic data. We stay out of politics, just business, economics, and finance.
Wolf Richter, please return in 2018.
Yes, we're looking forward to it. Thank you.